We've got the Bible study, and this is our Ask the Pastor Hour. Phones open at 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. In the studio with us, Pastor Alan Shade from Emmanuel Lutheran Church in St. Charles, Missouri. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good to have you with us today.
Thanks for being here. Let me be here.
Chuck Rathert has the morning off. Paul Clayton here sitting in and looking forward to taking phone calls from you, our listeners, at 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. It's Ask the Pastor on the Bible study. Well, you've got a spiffy new look to your website out there at Emmanuel St. Charles, Pastor.
We're very gifted to have a wonderful gentleman that loves doing it.
And, using some flash technique there, and you got photos and all kinds of good things right on the homepage. Very important information, the worship service schedule. Don't want to tuck that away somewhere. You want to put that right up in front. How are things at Emmanuel St. Charles?
It's busy time. School just started up again. So we've passed one pastor along to serve another congregation. Pastor Henning took a call to be an intentional interim pastor. And actually another pastor, Pastor Kunze, is deliberating a call. So he is looking for the Lord's will as to what to do with a call to Christ in Overland Park, Kansas. So.
Feeling left behind?
So, it could be a challenging time.
Yeah, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Before we begin, can we pray?
Let's. Father, your mercies are new to us every day. Your grace is always a surprise to us, presenting us opportunities to grow, to worship you, and to move forward in the confidence that you will bless our efforts in ways that connect people to Jesus and that bring that joy that you have placed in our hearts into the lives of others. Open our eyes to see you at work. Give us grace to respond to your directions and your invitations in our life. And give us compassion to see the needs of people around us so that we may respond to them in the name of Christ. In his name we pray. Amen.
Amen. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Is Friday ordinarily your day off?
It was, but when Pastor Henning left, that meant two of us had the same day off, so I've shifted around a little bit.
Appreciate your being here today. Do you have your sermon prepared for this weekend?
No, I don't. I'm still working on it.
You want a show prep? You want a sermon prep with me here? Because one of the readings, the gospel reading, will be Matthew 18, correct?
Yes, it is.
Boy, and that's just loaded with all kinds of things you could take apart. You've got the greatest in the kingdom of heaven there, the parable of the lost sheep, something that's used in the church a lot, and the passage about a brother who sins against you, and one thing that strikes me is verse 20 in chapter 18, for where two or three come together in my name, there am I with them. There's so many significant passages in this chapter that you've got a lot to choose from.
I'd like to, in my sermon, I'm moving up toward the front of the chapter because we often spend a lot of time in verses 15 to 20 for a variety of reasons. But I wanted to lay a foundation for that because the following week we do the next parable, the parable of the unmerciful servant. I want to help people realize the whole chapter is really about the gift of forgiveness and the emphasis that that puts into our lives. If I'm a forgiven child of God, it really alters the way I look at other people and how I look at people with little faith, uh-huh. How I look at people who wander from the faith, how I look at people who get caught up in sin. If I think about the level of forgiveness and the intensity of what God's grace has done in my life, it really alters my perspective on how I view others.
Now, that's the second time today I've heard from a pastor that this week's readings and next week's readings are connected. Well,
Matthew's not accidental in his arrangement of the materials. I mean, it's very deliberate, uh-huh. And of course the Lord... frankly, the Lord had to work with that hypocritical attitude in so many people that it just took enormous amounts of patience and reteaching and retelling to move people from our often self-righteous attitudes towards others to We're just two beggars trying to make our way along the same road, and we're both unworthy recipients of the mm-hmm. grace of God when we look at each other.
So. Well, let's see if I can stir something up here. Since you're going to be preaching on the first part of that chapter, there's a passage that states, and this is verse 5, whoever welcomes a little child like this in my name welcomes me. Oh, no, that's not the one I wanted. Here's the one I wanted. And he said, I tell you the truth, unless you change and become like this little child, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Therefore, whoever humbles himself like this child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. Is he asking us to have blind faith? To be like a child? That...
What's the primary characteristic that makes a child a good illustration of this? You know, how did children?
They're innocent. They're innocent.
Oh, innocent.
They don't know. They don't think too much.
Did you not raise children? I raised children that weren't innocent. They were selfish. They were jealous. They fought with each other. They couldn't share toys.
But they don't have all the baggage we have from all these years of trying to reason and think.
So they become more sophisticated at it, but they're still sinful people. That always makes me popular at the nursery in the hospital when they talk about a newborn and how innocent they are, and I want to remind them that they're pagans until we get them in baptism.
But it's easier for a child to believe in God and in Jesus. You know, the kids just take to it.
Well,
they believe it. The
reverse issue, that as we get older, we find more excuses not to believe. We get wrapped up in...
We have
in,
more doubts.
We get wrapped up in reason. We get wrapped up in logic. We get wrapped up in the modern view of the world that's scientifically driven. We have things that we can't explain away, so it becomes a problem for us, exactly.
So what are we supposed to do? Revert back to... not reasoning, not thinking, not trying to understand, or what?
Well, it is a matter, and some this is too complicated an argument, but this is often a matter of who's in charge in our lives, where what often drives us is, I want to be in control, and what things do I have at my disposal that justify my taking control? Well, I'm smart, right? Aren't you the smartest person in the world right after me?
Kind not of according to my wife.
Well, okay. We'll not go there unless you need a counselor. But we assume that our wisdom is good, that our opinions are valid, that we can listen to everybody else, but we'll make up our own mind because we tend to be right about all those kinds of things. And when we dump in our use of logic, our use of science, our experiences, those three or four times when we actually were right and we could say, I told you so, then we seem to put ourselves in the position, well, we're a little smarter than God. If God would just listen to me, things would get done in a much better way, mm-hmm. and we could handle things. So God hasn't called me and said, Al, I really need your advice on this situation. Please help me. I'm just stumped here as to what I'm going to do. But we presume that, like Job did, Job 38, where he's all set to give God advice for chapter after chapter after chapter, and God has to say, I don't recall needing your advice when I created the world and formed all of that. And to go back into childhood and simply take what God says and to focus on who God is and what he's done for us without all that clutter and without all that garbage, that's childlike faith, mm-hmm. to believe his promises and trust him. And God actually really does know what he's doing, and he can get it done, and I can... I was just reading a little thing in a book on Luther this last week where they come into the Diet of Augsburg and they're asking Luther what to do. And Luther says, well, shouldn't we wait on God and let God act? He really can handle this situation. We don't have to take it out of his hands and control it. You know, a classic worry mentality where I pray, God, please take care of this situation. And then no sooner is our amen over, then we pull the whole thing back and say, oh, this is really something I've got to do because obviously God can't handle it without me.
And that's not being led by the Holy Spirit at that point.
Not at all. Mm-hmm. Not at all. That's led by, you know, Satan whispering in our ears, don't you want to be God? Don't you want to know what's good and evil? Don't you want to decide what's good and evil? Make your choice yourself and not yield to God. Mm-hmm.
Does this next passage give us a different teaching on sin that's unique from other areas in the Bible. Woe to the world because of the things that cause people to sin. Such things must come, but woe to the man through whom they come. So often we think of sin in a personal way, what we do and how it impacts us. But is Jesus here pointing to woe to us who lead others into sin?
That's the concern. If you're have the compassion to look at what my actions and attitudes and lifestyle have as an impact on other people, then we kind of carry that burden and that responsibility. Our world is pretty selfish. I want to do what I want to do when I want to do it. If I want to speed down I-70 at 85 miles an hour, then you clearly have an obligation to get out of my way, because my getting there when I want to get there is more important than when you get there. So, you know, that kind of stuff. And Jesus is saying, wait a minute. This is a family. This is a community. This is a place where the stronger have an obligation to care for those who are little in the faith. By the way, this isn't reference just to children. This is anybody who's young in the faith or immature in the faith, an adult convert that doesn't know a great deal about the scriptures yet. Any of those are little ones in Jesus' perspective and need the care. Paul talks about this at great length, Romans 13, 14, 1 Corinthians 12, 13, and 14, the role of those who are more mature in the faith, having great concern what their example does to impact those who are less mature in the faith.
Hmm. Now, the next verses kind of bother me, because I've heard this stuff in Islam. And Jesus says, if your hand or foot causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. There have been cultures that do that kind of thing to people. It is better for you to enter life maimed or crippled than to have two hands or two feet and be thrown into eternal fire. And if your eye causes you to sin, gouge it out and throw it away. It is better for you to enter life with one eye than to have two eyes and be thrown into the fire of hell. Now, he doesn't mean this literally.
Not literally. This is more of a Jewish or Middle Eastern way of expressing things that talks about the will to do these things being in the instrument that would carry it out. But it balances out, and probably easier for us to understand when we think about Jesus saying out of the heart is the place where murders and false witness and adultery and all of those things proceed, so that I can't kill myself, I can't cut my heart out, but I'd virtually have to take my life in order to stop the will to sin. So my desire to be a thief would not end just because I cut my hand off. I'd find another way to do it. My desire for lust or misuse of the gift of sex would find another way, even if I did pluck my eye out. It's because it's so infusive in my nature. But Jesus is saying, go to whatever length is necessary to control the will to sin, because it's not just you, it's the impact you're having on others by the example that you're set. And some of us, you know, we're quite willing to minimize. You know, I don't feel like making the effort to minimize the damage I might do by my life, because then it might, you know, it might impact my freedom or my fun.
505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Let's talk to Brad. You're on the Bible study. It's Ask the Pastor with Alan Shade from Emmanuel St. Charles. Hi, Brad.
Good morning. Just on the heels of what you're talking about here, I have a family member who lost his job, and there's a lot of concern about his mortgage and his family and so forth. Another family member suggested he read the book of Job. So he did that. He came up with some questions on it, and he took it to his pastor. His pastor said that after much study in the book of Job and writing some papers on it, that he concluded that Job is actually a fable. What would your counsel be to that person? And also, what would you say to that pastor who said that?
I'm not sure why he would end up with it as a fable, or what his application would be. But even if you think of it as a literary effort that's trying to deal with it, you still have a powerful and wonderful dialogue in the book about Job wrestling with difficulties and struggles and burdens that come into his life, asking God for specific answers, and then God coming back to him at the end saying, Job, you are not going to be adequate to understand why I do everything that I do, but you know me, and you know that you can trust me, and you know that I love you, and that is the answer to the things, that God will always specifically do what we want him to do or provide an answer in the pattern and expectations that we have. Not there, but that God is an enormous, a wise, a compassionate, a caring, and a committed God to us. That's great stuff in Job. So I think whoever made that advice to him to use the book, is it's good advice. And the pastor, I'm not sure where he was coming from or if that's an out-of-context remark, but I don't take it as fable, and I think it's one of the most wise and profound books in the entire Old Testament, because what issue more than any other issue that we deal with challenges us in our Christianity? It's the reality of suffering in this world. Well, and then Job just pushes you right back to the cross. If I want to know what God is like, I know him because I stand at the foot of the cross and watch the suffering that his son was willing to go through in my behalf. And if that suffering could be a blessing to me, then the suffering that God allows into my life, God can use that to be a blessing to me as well. Job helps me see that, and it pushes me right back to the cross of Jesus Christ.
A really tough question. How are we lay people to discern what in the Bible is literal and what is symbolic?
It's all literal, okay? So that what literal means is you take it in its intended sense. There are symbolic aspects. You were talking last hour, Pastor Worth, about the 12 baskets in John 6 and the 12 use in Revelation. Well, in Revelation, the intended sense, the literal sense, is to use that great imagery of the Old Testament to help us understand the future church as well. The intended sense of a psalm is poetry, emotional expression, and the dialogue and drama of faith. Intended sense of miracle stories is the record of a real miracle that took place when Jesus walked on water and Peter got out of the boat and walked on water, resurrection of the dead. The intended sense of historical narrative is to tell us how God was at work in history. There's a variety of literary devices that are used, but it's their intended sense that we take. And we don't have permission to impose our preferences or our 21st century mentalities on those intended senses, but to get what the intended sense is. I mean, most of the authors don't hide their intended sense.
Mm-hmm. But we're not supposed to pluck our eye out.
No, that
would be literal.
I mean, how many of the apostles or the disciples that followed Jesus went into their ministries maimed, without a right hand or without a left foot or without an eye, kind of thing? They in the culture of the day, they knew the extent of seriousness that Jesus was expressing, without trying to make it. That's literal. That's oversimplifying kinds of things, or not using any context or the sense that God gives us when we study the literary purposes or the styles that are in which it is written. Matthew's very Jewish. You've got to expect him to write in a Jewish style. Luke and Mark, rather different from that, and John in his own unique style, and you have to take that in context. That's what scares me about people quoting one passage without looking at the context.
And I'll tell you, this chapter, it starts with a simple question, but then Jesus gets into all these random thoughts, it seems like. Perhaps with your education, you see connections, but it starts with who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven, and we hear about children. And so I guess I'm to assume that children are the greatest in heaven?
Those with childlike faith.
With childlike faith.
Okay.
But then we get into all these sheep and sheep wandering away, and we get into angels. There's reference to angels in here, and in fact, I wanted to ask you about that. See that you do not look down on one of these little ones, for I tell you that their angels in heaven always see the face of my Father in heaven. So, we have guardian angels?
We do have guardian angels. This is one of those passages, along with Hebrews, that talks about the ministering spirits that are sent forth to care for the saints of God. The point would be, who am I to consider someone insignificant if the creator of the world has assigned one of his servants, the angels, to guard and care for that person? How dare I treat somebody else as though, oh, they don't matter, kind of thing, when they have the attention of God, who is watching over and caring for every aspect of their life, counting the hairs of their head, sending an angel to attend them, listening to their prayers and their concerns, watching over every aspect.
Jesus is really complicated sometimes when he talks. He's hard to understand.
Well, it kind of makes it fun to keep going back through this. You know, I've been in love with the Gospel of Matthew since Dr. Frantzman introduced it to me years and years ago, but I've never come near mastering the text. It just excites me and gives me something. Remember that passage earlier, and I think it's the end of 13 with the parable chapter, where he talks about finding old treasures and new, bringing out those things. And, you know, we keep bringing out old things that are richly valued, but then finding new insights and applications for that in our daily lives. There aren't too many books that can compare with what the Scriptures do in challenging us to apply.
Well, Jesus certainly does challenge us to understand him, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not like reading Paul.
Well, Paul is a pretty good student of Jesus, which, you know, couple weeks we've had Romans 12 and 13, which really he spells out pretty clearly, but in some senses what he's doing is writing his own commentary on the Sermon on the Mount, and you know, Jesus was difficult to understand.
Yeah, it's almost, I get this impression that Paul's purpose was to explain what Jesus did and said.
I think that would be the purpose of every prophet and apostle and pastor.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That's a good point.
That's our role.
505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. It's Ask the Pastor. And before the break here, I might ask you, what's one of the most frequently asked questions of a pastor like yourself in a congregation?
That has to be context. I had two funerals this week, so, you know, the question that bounces out of funerals is an untimely death. You know, why does God allow someone, a young wife and mother, to die, or a young husband who hasn't had the chance to bring his children up completely into maturity, and why do they die, and why do they go through such miserable sufferings with cancer? That's a very common one. Sometimes it's, why did you go into the ministry? It's another provocative question. Why do you do what you do, sort of thing? It's another one of those fun ones. But most of those are contextual, depending on what's happening in people's lives or struggles that they're going through.
Or, will I see my spouse in heaven? Is that one that comes up?
That does come up. Yes, it does. And or pets, you know, when you're talking about kids, they want to know whether their pet's going to be in heaven. But that's a frequent one because of our definition of heaven.
Mm. Pastor Alan Shade, our guest, it's Ask the Pastor. Phone's open. You can come in during the break. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. We'll be right back with more on the Bible study on AM 850 KFUO.
The next Law and Gospel is Open Mic Friday, during which you have the opportunity to phone the station and ask how important are theological distinctions in areas of your interest. Perhaps you read or heard a devotion and have some question, or perhaps you just want to listen as others ask what might be also on your mind. Listen to Law and Gospel weekday afternoons from 1 till 3 on AM 850 KFUO.
It's life-changing excitement on the next Adventure in Odyssey. Feeling left out and left alone, Eugene Meltzner has hit rock bottom. With the closing of Wits End, his life has ended. Or has it? Facing the greatest decision in life, will Eugene forever wander lost or discover a new path to freedom? Make your decision next time on Adventures in Odyssey.
Saturday mornings at 8:30 on AM 850 KFUO.
A simple fungus proves to be not so simple. Learn about it next on today's Creation Moment.
And now, here's our Creation Moments host, Ian Taylor.
While we may speak of simple forms of life, the more we learn about simple things, the more clearly we can see that no form of life is simple. Evolution has long theorized that life began in a simple form that over millions of years gradually became more complex. Evolutionary scientists say that the simple forms of life are still in existence today, and to prove their claim, they point to the lowly fungus. Okay, let's see how simple the lowly fungus really is. The cap-throwing fungus has a built-in clock and bends through the day in response to the sun's movement. The built-in clock of the cap-throwing fungus waits until it is turned to the best possible angle before blowing its top to distribute the spores or seeds over the widest possible area. The light-sensing system in the fungus releases the spores at about 9 in the morning, aiming the spores at an area that is most likely to be open so that they can be spread even further by animals. Whether the spores land where animals pass or on a leaf, they are coated with glue to aid in further dispersion. The lowly fungus reminds us that there just aren't any simple forms of life. This fungus has been given sophisticated ways to carry out God's command to reproduce after its kind.
For more information, visit us online at creationmoments.com. You'll find both written and audio transcripts, creation-focused articles and Bible studies, and many other resources, all at creationmoments.com. Or call us toll-free at 1-800-42-BIBLE. And be sure to join us next time for another Creation Moment, proclaiming evidence of God's truth.
Hi, this is Chuck Rafferty. If you're a day sponsor on AM850KFUO, thank you so much for your support. If you've thought about becoming a day sponsor, may I suggest that September might be an ideal time to take that step. We have a number of open dates in the month of September where you can remember a birthday or anniversary, honor your church or pastor, or any other important event or occasion, and support AM850KFUO at the same time. If you'd like to become a day sponsor, call Dorothy Kessner at 1-888-4-KFUO-AM.
AM850KFUO is underwritten in part by Reliable Heating and Cooling, with a showroom in the Mid-County Trade Center, 8463 Delport Drive. Reliable Heating and Cooling features Lennox air conditioning and furnace systems and services all brands. Reliable also provides senior discounts. Reliable Heating and Cooling, serving you from North, Mid, and West County exchanges. The next time you call Reliable at 423-3535, please thank them for being an AM850KFUO underwriter.
Welcome back. This is Ask the Pastor on the Bible Study. Pastor Alan Shade with us from Emmanuel Lutheran Church in St. Charles, Missouri. Church and school, I should say. Yes. In one of the most booming counties in the country, in the United States.
It's going to fill up pretty soon. I mean, there's only so many houses you can put in the county. But, Wentzville and now Lincoln County is getting many of the same kinds of impacts. So the move west, gas prices are impacting that quite a bit. Mm-hmm. But St. Charles pretty much getting filled up. Wentzville is almost there. O'Fallon's getting much closer too.
And yours, the historic church, I suppose, there in St. Charles County. Huh?
The oldest one is actually St. Paul Numeli. We're a daughter church of St. Paul Numeli.
I had no idea.
And they're the same. They're being overwhelmed with enormous growth in that part of the county, south of Wentzville.
Mm-hmm. We've got some phones here to take
Excellent.
Care of. Let's talk to our friend Linda in Farmington. You're on the Bible Study with Pastor Alan Shade. Hi there.
Hi, Polly.
Good to have you here.
Hi, Pastor.
Good morning.
Good morning. Well, there's a verse, a passage that I'm looking at in Matthew 22, verse 32, and Jesus is speaking to the crowd about the resurrection, and he's saying what God has said, I am the God of Abraham and the God of Isaac and the God of Jacob. God is not the God of the dead, but of the living. And does that mean that God does not regard our loved ones who have gone on to eternity, who have been born into eternal life? He doesn't regard them as being dead. He's the God of the living. And Christians, should we speak of our loved ones who have gone into eternity as being dead And doesn't it give us greater hope if a pastor counsels us to have children in heaven and loved ones in heaven? Isn't that more of a comfort if you remind them, God is the God of the living, you know?
It has that potential because St. Paul usually did not refer to Christians as having died. He always talked about them as being asleep in reference to their bodies, but that their souls are already with Christ in heaven. Sure.
And you know, you think, well, there was a passage Paulie brought up a while ago, where two or three are gathered in my name, there I am among you. And that's a promise that, you know, when we're gathered in his name, he is among us. And not only the two or three that might come to church, but the whole host of heaven and all those who have gone on to heaven, they're with us on the other side of that altar that we can't see with Jesus. And he's there because he promises, and he brings all of them because he promises. They're worshiping with us on the other end of the kingdom.
I'm reminded of the symbolism of the old circle chancels where you had an altar in the middle and then a circle behind the altar, as well as a circle in front for the communicants and the hymn phrase, the saints above and saints below but one communion make. And the North European chancels had that image that when we come up for communion, we're communing on earth, and there's the saints that have gone before us are communing in heaven. Yeah. And there's a kind of a joint meal that takes place in anticipation of the final resurrection.
Hallelujah. God bless you.
Thank you, Linda. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. James, you're on the Bible Study with Pastor Alan Shade.
Good morning, Brother Paul.
Good morning.
Good morning, Pastor.
Good morning.
I'd first like to say that I really enjoy the morning show call. I try to catch you as much as I possibly can now. And,
you're very kind. Thank you.
And I listen to you on Wrestling with the Basics also.
Right.
But, Pastor, I have two questions. My first question is, I'd like for you to help me understand what's being said in Proverbs chapter 16, verse 18 through 20. And that's Proverbs 16, verses 18 through 20.
Okay, we're getting there.
Okay. And my second question is, basically, I'd like for you to make a quick comment on is, can a Christian with a supercilious look and a sanctimonious posture use sarcasm and satire to strongly attack others' world views and ideologies? Is that a proper way to exercise apologetics, or would you say a grace-oriented approach of toleration that puts the best construction on others' points of view?
Are you talking about politicians here?
Well, it kind of made me think about that when I looked at the convention last night. So I'd just like to know, would you say that a grace-oriented approach of toleration that puts the best construction on others' points of view in seeking to evangelize them is best, as opposed to the Christian being, you know, supercilious and sanctimonious and stuff like that?
Now you're butting up against two kingdoms here, I think, but go ahead, Pastor.
Well, let's pick up the Proverbs question first. You're requesting an explanation of Proverbs 16, 18 to 20. I have the NIV that says, pride goes before destruction. A haughty spirit is before a fall. That almost sounds like our Ben Franklin thing, that pride goes before the fall thing. Better to be lowly in spirit and among the oppressed than to share plunder with the proud. Whoever gives heed to instruction prospers, and blessed is he who trusts in the Lord. The humble spirit that Jesus talks about, Peter talks about, humble yourself that God may exalt you in due time. The example that Paul uses in Philippians 2 to suggest let the humble mind of Jesus be your pattern for an attitude, and the deference to that, to allow God to exalt us and not worry about it. I'm not sure if there's another question underneath that or not.
No,
James is gone. Okay. Mm-hmm. But straightforward in endorsement of the concept of humility over against the mentality of pride. Now, the other question about sarcasm, I think this is a contextual thing. we, in a Christian day school, you know, you have to be very cautious and need to be cautious about when you're working with children's minds and when you're working with the immature and when you're working with formation of an attitude and a heart thought and a self-image, sarcasm is an enormously cruel potential to destroy people. But the alternate to that, I think, is if you read Matthew 23 and you look at the way in which Jesus dealt with the scribes and the Pharisees, there's an enormous amount of sarcasm in Matthew 23 where he talks about the scribes and the Pharisees and their pretense of great religiosity, but it's empty. It doesn't have it. So when there were folks that were coming across with enormous pride, with a very pompous and self-satisfied attitude, Jesus could use some pretty stinging rebukes that, if they weren't sarcasm, they were very close to it. There are examples of ironic sarcasm in some of the Old Testament prophets, from Isaiah and Jeremiah. Ezekiel has some language that is that way too. When the obstacle against which they were prophesying needed a very solid jolt, a real heavy hammer hitting them, sarcasm was one of the tools. It depends on how it's used and where it's used. If I'm talking about little children, childlike faith, those who are immature in the faith, those with no background and understanding in the scriptures, there I think a gentle spirit of grace is far more appropriate and indicated.
505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Jim's on the line with Pastor Alan Shade of Emmanuel Lutheran Church in St. Charles. Good morning, Jim.
Hey, good morning, Paul, and Brother Shade, and Brother Paul, I should say.
Thanks for the call.
Sarcasm. Elijah had a lot of sarcasm there at Mount Carmel with the prophets of Baal.
Very good example.
Jesus Christ had a lot of sarcasm with the Pharisees, called them a bunch of snakes, bunch of hypocrites, bunch of whited sepulchers. Paul had a lot of sarcasm whenever he was in jail. They put him and Silas in jail. Remember the night the jailer got saved and his whole household? They sent one of the police officers down there to release him. He said, uh-uh. He said, you put a Roman citizen in this jail. He said, you go tell the official of the city to get himself down here and escort us out of town. And I think sometimes God expects us to use sarcasm, not to the point, to the losing of some souls or to the wasting of our testimony. But there are some people that you deal with that you have to be... that you had to be right down mean to. So I'll just listen to you, to your comment.
Thanks for the call, Jim.
I'm reminded of, I think it was Paul Faust used the illustration when he was talking about evangelism. He said, when a plumber comes to your house and he has a whole truck full of tools, he goes in and he looks at the situation first, and then he goes back to the truck and he gets the right tool. And when we're dealing with an individual that is in struggle with the truth or with understanding the word and will of God, sarcasm may be a tool that might be used in certain situations, but you don't want to get in the situation where what's the old joke about, if the only tool you have is a hammer, then everything looks like a nail. There are issues of folks that use sarcasm so often and so frequently that it appears that it's their only tool, and that is not an appropriate pattern. It has its place, and it has a way of working with those who are overly excited about their own pride or their own intelligence or their own opinions, and a way to make them even laugh at themselves in some cases, or to cut them down to size. But oftentimes, I've watched sarcasm be used in ways that it was simply cruel and it was games playing. It had nothing to do with trying to help the person. It had everything to do with trying to look smarter than the other person and raise your own view of yourself in other people's eyes. That's inappropriate.
Well, let's go there. James was alluding to it. How should Christians who enter politics conduct themselves? Is there a higher responsibility?
I think John McCain alluded to it last night in his speech. I didn't hear all of it, but I heard some of it. And the gut level mentality is that you are to take the high road and you are to be a servant. And there are situations where you have to point out the realities of other things, the flaws in other people's arguments. You have to be able to analyze, and you have to be able to communicate in a way in which people will listen to you and that gets your point across. But that doesn't necessarily mean that we need to be vitriolic and attacking the persons in order to accomplish our purposes. I go back to Luther that there are clear responsibilities that are articulated for those who are going to be in government leadership, and their responsibilities are different in the kingdom of the left because they use reason and they are entrusted with force to be able to do those things, and they don't operate on a grace premise, but they still have to be moral and ethical individuals in how they do that, and they have to sleep at night with their consciences.
There are some talk show hosts who are very prideful, very haughty, and mean-spirited. And Christians love some of these people, listen to them every day. Are those hosts causing, let's go back to where we started, these Christians to sin?
I don't listen to all of those, so I would be hesitant about kind of painting them all with the same brush.
But there are Christians rooting for these hosts to really take them down. Be as sarcastic as you can.
I would have to say I'm gonna watch my own sinful self before I cast stones at others, but realize that that's enormous temptation to bring out the worst in us, and or to do it and say, you know, how many times have you watched something like that and said, well, they know what they're getting into, and it's only entertainment. You know, we don't do anything.
Right.
We're just entertaining people. Well, there was once a form of entertainment called throwing Christians to the lions. I'm not going to advocate that because it has historical precedence and because it's been done before, because there were people that actually enjoyed it, therefore we should do it too. I think we can come up with better arguments than that.
Is there a two-kingdom issue here?
I'm not sure that that's so much two-kingdom issue.
Christians in politics, I mean, they got to get elected. Does anything go?
Well, that's an enormous struggle. What is a Christian willing to do in order to be elected? And if their handlers, their coaches, their press agents, and so on are coaching them to do things that are unethical, then I think they step back and let the chips fall where they may. We have some wonderful Christian people that are representing us, and sometimes they don't survive out there too long.
You know, this has nothing to do with Ask the Pastor or the Bible study, but since we're in this realm, I just got to share with you, one of my pet peeves is when I see a commercial of a politician, the commercial is sponsored by the politician who wants to get elected, and his opponent is depicted in slow motion. Have you seen the ones of John McCain in the golf cart with former President Bush, and they slow him down so that he looks like he's just old and sleepy and dopey?
Yeah.
And that's unethical. And that turns me against the person who's running the ad.
My pet peeve is probably more the late night talk shows, and it doesn't seem to matter which one I tune into. They have set up a series of ridicules of President Bush that create a mentality in people's mind that he is nothing but a foolish bumpkin who can't, you know, he can't say a speech without stumbling over a word, or he can't understand the complexities of being president. And they're only doing it for entertainment, and they'll have that person on, and they'll treat him like they're their best buddy. But I think they need to be conscious of, or they ought to be held accountable for being conscious that you create an image by certain things that you do or choose not to do, and that's not an accident, or it's not something for which they won't be held accountable eventually.
It looks like this election season is going to be a real barn burner, and people are fired up. And I just wonder how much of that comes onto the campus of a congregation like yours. Do people talk about politics at church?
I don't get asked a lot of direct political questions. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether that's because they assume I'll come from a particular perspective on things, or that where I stand on issues is clear enough that people will just take the next step and apply logic to that point of thing. But I'm not asked to what candidate I'm endorsing or
mm-hmm.
or that kind of question on a very, very frequent basis.
But in your experience, if one is a conservative Christian, does that necessarily mean they're going to be conservative when it comes to things in the secular world or in politics?
I'd rather go issue by issue on that sort of thing, because I don't want to come across that Christians endorse automatically a particular style of government.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that democracy is right and socialism is automatically wrong. Those kinds of mentalities. We do have our specific kinds of issues and that Christians are going to frequently talk about. We are interested in protecting marriage for a lot of reasons. First of all, because of the biblical principles about marriage, but also because we understand the stability of a nation if marriage is put under attack. We know that certain kinds of positions have led frequently in history and in biblical studies to deteriorating conditions in society, so we have that collected wisdom that's going to point out the foolishness of those kinds of arguments or those directions. But Luther did try to articulate, and I think appropriately so, that there are certain fundamental principles by which you govern and certain fundamental guidelines by which you operate the church. And messing up those two between is precarious and dangerous and not accomplishing God's purposes.
We see a clear distinction between the two parties on the issue of abortion over the past 2 weeks. They both brought it up. It was on the back burner, it seemed, during the early part of the campaign season, the primary season. But now it's out there.
Yeah.
And it's... Is it incumbent upon Christians to consider that issue?
It's an issue they cannot ignore, but it in the choices, we don't get to vote on issues. We have to vote on individuals. So in the final analysis, you are going to be forced to stand in the ballot box and select on an issue. And there are Christians in good conscience who say, I will make my choice based on that particular issue. And there are other Christians who would step back and say, given the complexity of issues that we are going to have to deal with in the realm of this particular candidate, I'm concerned about his position on life issues, and I will be an advocate towards him. But in a larger number of issues that must be dealt with under the realm of government, I'll have to pick that candidate, even if he doesn't line up exactly where I would like him to be on life issues.
Mm-hmm.
So there's an oversimplification that sometimes takes place that I'm leery of.
Yeah, over the past 2 weeks, and I'm just speaking personally for myself, this became very important to me because the parties brought it out. They brought it out on the front burner, and I don't know if I can consider any of those other issues until we get this one fixed.
Well, I have been fearful of and this is not pastor stuff, this is personal Al Shade stuff, so I don't have authority to speak on these issues. I've been concerned about the Republican Party that it seems to be stepping back from a strong support for life issues, so the selection of Governor Palin as a candidate and her position on that is refreshing to me. You know, that somebody that's listened. I haven't had that same level of confidence in terms of the Republican Party and its general drift of things. But that's a strong statement and an encouraging one.
And I guess it's good that this is back on the front burner.
It is good. Again, you have you need to have Christians concerned about those issues that have such an enormous moral impact on the culture and the society, because the government you're going to get is just a byproduct of what the culture is doing, sort of thing. So as much as politicians would like to say so, I don't know that they set the tone as much as read the tone.
Oh, yeah.
Kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So if your society is drifting into amorality and an attack on everything that is fundamental in God's good wisdom for this world, then that has to drive and compel Christians to be far more active in the political realms and to be as influential as they can possibly be in that way. By voting is one thing, but by active participation in the roles is another.
As we get caught up in the rhetoric and the commercials and the momentum of this election season, we need to remember to pray about our decision, shouldn't we?
And we need to be grateful that God is in control. You know, that he has called us to an activity level, and he has also taught us to believe that he will accomplish his purposes even when it doesn't look like it from our humble perspective.
Did God have a hand in who these candidates are?
My goodness. The Old Testament taught me that God has a hand in all of those kinds of things. When God needed an Assyrian king to come in and punish Israel for their idolatry, he raised up the Assyrians, and when he was done with the Assyrians, they disappeared from the face of the earth. And when God needed Nebuchadnezzar to chastise the people of Judah because of their idolatry and unfaithfulness to the covenant, he raised up Nebuchadnezzar, and when Nebuchadnezzar had accomplished his purpose, shazam, he was gone, and off that goes. And we know from history that God uses unfaithful, idolatrous, unbelieving individuals to accomplish his purposes, and when they're done, they're gone.
Governor Sarah Palin yesterday was quoted as saying that she believes God has a hand in what's happening in Iraq.
I would say, how can you disagree
with
that?
Is that an accurate statement?
Where does God not have his hand involved? You know, that, you know, sometimes I think there is a presumptive foolishness on the part of many Christians that somehow God isn't present unless I think he is or I send him there to be. You know, even in my own life, come into my life, dear Lord, as though God is not involved in my life unless I tell him to come into my life. That, you know, he's there, he's active, it's his world, he's going to be involved in all the aspects of it.
That's the Bible study, Ask the Pastor. And Pastor Alan Shade, thank you for being with us today.
My pleasure. God bless.
Chuck Rathert returns on Monday. Paul Clayton thanking you for listening.
Listen to Chuck Rathert and guests Monday through Friday at the same time on the Bible study. The Bible Study is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is needed for the Bible Study to continue. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can contact us on the Internet at kfuo.org. For a free copy of the Bible Study, please visit the audio archive section of our homepage. That's kfuo.org. The Bible Study is a broadcast service of Worldwide KFUO.